Thank you all for being here. We do still expect Representative Rayfield, and as far as I know, Daniel Lukow will be here. Hopefully Rob Horatio will join us on the phone. On the phone, in addition to Jody Weiser as a member of the public, we have Serena Boston Ashby and Brad Martin from the Democratic Party of Oregon joining us by phone. We continue our quest for more than a bare majority on something that will help to move us forward. I'd like to report back. We have not heard from everybody on the on our little survey of kind of a range of public financing ideas. At the moment, we stand at eight fairly firm folks interested in exploring it. Some in the light side, some on the full side of things. Some just willing to explore anything, you know, in that range. Others only if it was light. Others only if it's full. So, you know, a great variety of opinions offered within that. When we have maybe everybody's input, I could certainly CC. We can cut and paste what people have written and put it all in one document so you can see where people landed. But what I would hope to do is, since there certainly is a majority of interest in exploring around it, when we come to the end of the meeting and we see what areas we might have where we've got a little bit of consensus or majority opinion to try to pull some pieces of a package together, we'll think about how we could ask a group to work with me or decide how we could perhaps put together the outlines of something for the group to consider in October. We'll sort of do probably several things in these categories that we have. And unless anybody wants to offer their additional vote now or send me a note, I can fill these out. You're always outspoken, so.
Well, I'll add my vote for either public financing option.
Okay. All right. Brings us to nine, as long as you count the chair. Hang on a second, Margie. Go ahead.
The Oregon Republican, we do not support any public financing, and we want to maintain the tax credit.
Maintain and no consideration of expansion, or on the tax credit side, might an exploration of expansion of the tax credit be in order? Okay, wonderful. Excuse me, hang on just so that I keep my notes straight. Yes, Representative Kenner, are you?
Yes, thank you. Well, Margie and I didn't have a conversation. I support both of those positions. I'm opposed to public funding, and I think we ought to broaden the tax credit and make it larger and available to all Oregonians.
Yes, and we thank you, Representative Kenner. You had responded, so
yeah, I did.
I had that. I did have that information. So there is at least some interest in the group in looking further at the tax credit piece, but there is, I think, a nine or so of the bigger group that would like to, at this point, that would like to look at public financing as well. Might be of a light sort, might be of a little bit more fulsome part. And again, I think when we come to the end, I'll invite folks to help work with me to say, are there outlines of a proposal that we can bring to the group and see what people's reactions are to that. Have more of a debate about those next meeting. Yes.
Are there just two of us in opposition, or do you have that tally yet?
I don't have a full tally yet, mm-hmm. But no, there are one, two, three, three-firm no's, and I've not heard from Senator Boqvist on the matter, or Representative Rayfield, or Rob Brascio at this point on the matter. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Right. As I said, we're not really, we're not assuming that we're going to have unanimity. We probably will have a minority report of some kind, no matter what kinds of things that we do. But we were, by the urging of legislative leadership, trying to get a little bit above a one-vote majority for something that we might bring to them. So I think we've moved a little bit along that path with the public financing, and it's worth having another discussion about it, but perhaps with sort of more facts and things attached to it. I understand that for some folks who are against it, it's really a matter of, it's a principled matter that won't change depending on the proposal that's in front of you. But for the folks who have an interest in putting something forward on that mind, there's a variety of ideas. And they may fall off as it comes. We might not end up with a majority for whatever it is that we're proposing. We accept our differences. Otherwise, we're going to fall in a hole here. So I think that's really true. And we will know when we're speaking as a group united and when we're not. That'll be made obvious to legislative leadership and others, as we did last time. So my hope was that, well, go ahead.
Just a question to back up on this. Looking at your continuum of things here, when you have opposed to public financing system open to incentives, on the People's Pledge, that doesn't require any public financing, correct? It sort of looks like the continuum, that's, you got the status quo in the middle. But isn't the People's Pledge something a little...
Folks speak louder or closer to the microphone.
All right, sorry. Isn't the...
Rob's moving closer to the microphone.
I don't know if that's going to help or not. That doesn't pick up probably the phone. But for the people who want to maintain the status quo, would they still be opposed to some sort of People's Pledge with state recognition? I don't know.
Some who did and some who did not.
Okay.
Opinions that were offered.
All right. So I'm assuming when
the
people...
The question was whether or not People's Pledge incentive participation there might be an alternative to folks who are opposed to public financing, whether or not they also think tax credit pieces.
Well, that's my question, I guess. We talked about public financing, not specifically about People's Pledge. And I guess People's Pledge could also take various forms. It could just be recognition by the state. There's no necessarily state money involved in a People's Pledge. It's just recognition of a contractual agreement that candidates have made, from what I understand. A private agreement with simply maybe state recognition at some location, possibly in voters' pamphlet, or maybe not. But I'm just curious as to whether people who want to maintain the status quo are also opposed to some sort of a People's Pledge enforcement mechanism. I don't know. Maybe that's not, it's not for me to answer, but I'm just asking that question.
Go ahead, Representative Kenner.
Yes, and if we had a discussion of the People's Pledge here, I don't.
It was earlier on.
It was before I got here. Good. Okay. I had a birthday recently, and I was worried. Okay. You know, I looked that up on the internet, and at least the version that I saw, you know, what happened. I had a lot of difficulty with it because what happened is if you had expenditures on your behalf that you did not coordinate, then you would contribute to charity of the other your opposition's choice an equivalent amount of money, and I found that pretty unrealistic in our current system of funding campaigns. And is that the pledge that we were looking at? That's
there are, I think it was not proposed as the only one, but the system that was used in Massachusetts was described, and that was
the
threat that was over the top of them. I don't recall, and we could certainly put that material together again so that you can have a clear view of it as we, if we want to discuss it further, but do others recall whether there has been an effort to actually enforce by forcing a contribution on somebody? Has that actually taken place, Dan? Do you know?
It was always an agreement between two candidates in the same race so that they could bring social pressure on to them to comply rather than some legal pressure.
Right. It wasn't necessarily a legal pressure, but the fact that they did or didn't choose to offset an in-kind contribution was something that they did was... and to be an issue raised in the campaign, not necessarily enforced by a contract.
I think in Massachusetts, and I think they did a little bit in Rhode Island too, is that they just had contracts that candidates could enter into. And it said, like, if there was an independent, I think it's independent expenditure more than in kind, but independent.
Sorry.
Yeah, if independent expenditure over a certain amount, then, like, if it benefits you, then you have to give up half that amount to a charity you both agree on, like, you know, maybe a children's hospital or a, you know, a local food bank or something. But it is a voluntary agreement that candidates enter. It doesn't seem to, it's, unlike public financing, it doesn't cost the government any money. So, and I know that there have been pretty, I think, productive conversations about what it could achieve, too. So, we can, of course, craft in any way that we think would make sense for Oregon, but it is a model that has had success in other states.
Before I go to you, Kyle, can I check in on the phone? Are you hearing a little better, or is that we still need to fix that?
It's a little better.
Okay. All right. So
the last speaker was still hard to hear.
Okay. So pull the mic to you, if you would.
It won't help. It's that microphone I have to talk to. So I'll try to project that way.
Hopefully, if you're louder
Aaron
in the room,
feels like
then you're also louder.
They've tried to tie
tie the phone and the microphones together. So they are monitoring it downstairs.
Make an effort.
Yeah.
See if pulling it closer will help.
Okay. So I may be one of the people that Mr. Harris was trying to ask. I am open to ways that we could look at making voluntary People's Pledge-like agreements legally enforceable. I think that would be all right. But I would not want any special recognition for that because I think it comes with some pretty bad strings. It would very quickly lead to the government specifying the criteria such an agreement must include if you want to get that gold star in the voters' pamphlet, which I don't think you should have.
And I'm sorry, but it's actually gotten worse. It's almost as if that microphone...
Pull the microphone all the way to you.
And second. I'll repeat what he said, so go ahead.
Okay, thank you. And secondly, a candidate who, for principled reasons, would not want to attempt to limit the speech of other groups would thereby be disadvantaged simply because of a political position that they have, and that would amount to government endorsing of the opposite political position.
So what Kyle is confirming is there was at least one position taken that in fact, a People's Pledge that had any kind of an incentivizing element by the government. For instance, this is something that you could put in the voters' pamphlet and brag on. Might or might not be problematic in the sense that he would not like to see pressure on somebody to violate what might be their own principles about limiting other people's speech and government getting intruded on it. But I guess the bigger question, and I'll come back to it at the end of our discussion today to just make sure that's fine, is if there were three or four people who spoke positively about People's Pledge, that didn't necessarily mean that everybody who didn't speak positively of it was opposed to that as one element of something that we might put forward, and we'll make a decision perhaps at the end whether People's Pledge kind of a structure is something that we'd like to at least see drafted with enough detail that we could have this discussion. Go ahead, Representative Rayfield.
I was just going to say I'm not necessarily opposed to that. I don't think it will have a huge impact, and it's a lot of effort for something that, quite frankly, if I was running against somebody and we wanted to enter into an agreement, boy, we'd sit there, we'd enter into it, and I could do that now, and I could put it in my voter's pamphlet statement. And I don't need a legislature to tell me to do that. I do fear there are some campaigns that get run, and outside expenditures do come in for one reason or another because they feel that things are better. And let's say that this candidate was not raising a lot of money, and outside folks came in and said, hey, we want to go ahead and fund all of this stuff, and they don't have any money in their bank account to pay any of these fines. I think there could be some interesting nuances that could go on with this, or you know, you could have bad actors that say, you know what, we want to take half of Dan Rayfield's money on this, and so we're going to do independent expenditures that look like they're supporting him but really aren't, but could be deemed that way, and then we get into a question of fact about one way or the other. That's the attorney part of me that figures the worst case scenario. So I'm just worried, you know, if we're looking at expending a bunch of energy to move something, I would rather kind of preferably focus on something that has more of a broader impact, like, you know, the public financing, the small dollar donor matching program or something like that. But I'm not opposed to it, I think, is what your question was.
And I think that was my assumption about why people were not necessarily mentioning it one way or the other. But I will kind of ask for a sense of the group at the end of today's meeting to see whether a development of a draft or an idea, if it were to be presented to the legislature, would be of enough interest to come to the group next week and have a good debate about, is it worth having as part of a package? Is it worth having as the only thing that people don't hate? Is it, where are we? And get that sense. Dave.
I would just echo Representative Rayfield. I'm not opposed to the People's Pledge, but I really don't feel it's going to have that much effect.
Well, we're duly warned that we have not necessarily great enthusiasm, but some interest at the moment. But I'm hoping we can kind of get through a list of a variety of the things to see where we are, whether it's worth investing some time between now and the October meeting to begin to draft an outline. So kind of think about that as the goal here with all of the number of things that we have. Yeah, can we do a quick... look in on the phone, and number one, is anybody else added? And number two, does anybody who's a task force member have something they want to add at this point?
Gene, this is Brad, and obviously I think our task is important, but also fairly complicated. When we're looking to the October meeting, I hope we might kind of take two tracks, one which would be a package. But then secondly, that we might look at the individual pieces. There may be something that most of us or all of us agree on that we could move forward. And it seems to be things around reporting and transparency. There seems to be at least some general agreement. And I'd want to see if there might be an item that may not be the biggest change, but still would be important change on the path, even while we're sorting out the items that there's more division on. So just... for what it's worth, maybe take both texts.
Thank you. Good thinking. Has anybody else joined us on the phone? Go ahead.
No, this is Serena. I definitely support Brad's comments, and this is my first time participating, so I'm just getting a bit oriented here. So that's what I'll say thus far.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, a lot for the folks who've come on new that we've been through, and our records are all on the web if you want to dig down into them. But I understand that can also be a little bit daunting. As I indicated in our emails out, that I'd like to see whether we could make some progress on what's a pretty lengthy list of things that had come up during the course of our discussions that are neither public financing nor constitutionally approved potential for campaign limits, which we've dug into pretty deeply, and several of you did. Add one or more items to the list that I sent out. And I have kind of divided them in four categories. They don't separate easily into equivalent areas, but I'm hoping that we could do a little bit of an experiment maybe with some small groups that would look at a section of these of this list and help the larger group by just in the time that you are meeting together try to identify whether or not this idea is something which might move forward some of the goals that we talked about back at the very beginning. And I'll get have a list of those in front of you so you can be reminded of that, or might work against them, might be kind of the opposite. And my hope is that when the groups come back to the full group, that we can get from you sort of both sides of the equation. Folks have pretty firm ideas themselves about what they would like to see or not like to see, but this is an effort to sort of see if in small groups you can at least construct what the positive and the negative argument might be about one or more of these to bring back to the group so that then we can decide, is this something worth pursuing a little further, not committing the group to it, don't have to, you know, sit on, you know, take a line in the sand on it at this point, but whether or not it has some relevance to what we're trying to accomplish and therefore is worth pursuing a little further. Out of that, we might find, as both Brad and Serena enforced, the one thing that everybody agrees on, or we might find, you know, there are several things that might be combined, and we will add at the end, thinking about whether or not we want to construct a possibility around public financing and people's pledge as well. So I'm hoping the legislators would be willing to be separate out into the groups and do this work. You're kind of set in a pretty good variety of opinions away already. With the one lead thing that I would say is, one is obviously Representative Rayfield's been working on independent expenditures and has a variety of things in a bill that almost came to fruition in 2016 and some additional thoughts that he's considering. He's kind enough to be willing to, you know, to put that out there, and perhaps you'll be on the group that goes through your list. It might be of value to you to hear people's input on those issues. Where there's a bill language that maybe it's been introduced before, or somebody had, Kyle had brought a couple things forward in a previous meeting, and I put the one-page sheet with those, the descriptions you made of them, into these. For you two folks on the phone, we'll join you in a group up here, but I have tried to provide you a little bit of the background here, since not everybody's got a computer in front of them to link in. And the questions that I'm hoping that you'll use your time to try to answer for each and be prepared to tell to the bigger group, or really, would changing the law in whatever this area is be a way to meet one or more of the objectives that we had set out for ourselves? And what are the potential downsides to such a thing for our goals? And you might have a big downside, which is if we aren't doing this other bigger thing, it won't help. I mean, there's a variety of ways you could approach that, but understanding and trying to help other folks see what might be the positives and the negatives of this could help us maybe get to a little bit of understanding. So I'm trying to think whether maybe we could have the two folks on the phone with Norm and Seth, since that might work, and if this group would be one, and one of the legislators would be willing to join them.
I have a question.
Yes.
Ms. Secretary, so are we assuming as we go through this exercise that there will be no amendment to the Constitution, that we're going to work with what we've got within the parameters that we have?
At the moment.
Okay.
We probably, before we make our next report, we'll need to come back. To that question, if you want to address it again. But yes, and so there may be questions about some of these. We do have Dan Gilbert watching us and available to come up if we had a quick question. I'd like to not get too much down a rabbit hole of, I mean, if there's interest in it and we're uncertain about its constitutional stature, then that's something we could go and explore and come back with it. I'd rather not get stuck on that question. But that was the idea, was that if there was potential constitutionality of all of these, and that may not be entirely true, so it's worth raising the question.
But I assume, since we voted already on a particular constitutional amendment, that that's still part of our report,
record.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So
And when, yeah, if anybody wants to revisit it and pull the group again. So
I've got to say there's been a number of changes in the membership, so I don't think that assumption reflects where we are in time. That was a recommendation to the last session. It's still obviously on the books, but I think we'd have to have a fairly expansive conversation as reflected in the first meeting that I was at. So I don't want us to get bogged down in this, but large number of change in membership, fairly significant issue. And I'd be very troubled if it was represented or moved forward without a fairly significant revisiting. Ms. Brad.
Fair enough. Yep.
So I'm not clear. Are the small groups going through the other than public financing recommendations?
Yes. Okay. Yes, indeed. And the folders have the section. They're divided in the sections that you see here, except that these are combined because they're smaller. It was an effort to make kind of an equivalent number of things to look at. We have reporting and transparency, enforcement, and penalties. We have represent Ray Field's efforts, and then I combined new prohibitions and changes in ethics laws into one. So shall I just assign, because asking you to volunteer is mean?
Sure.
Take it away. Would you be willing, Representative Kenover, to join a group at the end of the table here, this group, and kind of go through those and see what people think about them? And I'm happy to move about, as I'm sure Aaron is, and help people. And Representative Rayfield has his things there, and then
they come up here.
Yeah. If Norman and Seth would come up here, we could include the people on the phone.
Do you want me to go to the end of the table?
Okay. The portfolio, apparently.
We're going to talk about every item?
No. Just the ones on your. I'll give you a folder.
In the folder. Okay.
Have I oversold the legislators here? Somebody sensible.
We have Seth those. And Norman need a legislator.
There's only three legislators that are
still. Well, you're sort of a legislator.
Yeah, we'll make me then. That's right. Yeah, Diane will join this group there.
I'll go to the end.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. And we'll have but I'll let somebody else take the lead, if you will, so it's not. So we need to put the task force in recess, although we want the two folks to stay on the phone and join us while we do what will probably be a little bit difficult for the member of the public to hear. But at any rate, we'll go into recess for I think maybe 45 minutes,
and
we'll come back and discuss at 10. Yes. If we need more, we can ask for more. I'll say that we'll come back together at 10:15. If people are still struggling, we can make that a little bit longer. Thank you. Has to remind me to use the gavel here. And folks may have gone on and off the phone. Do we still have Brad and Serena on the phone?
I'm here.
Yay.
I'm here.
Very good. Thank you so for hanging in. I know it's hard on the phone. I think you both hope to be here next time. Although I know October is not any easier for folks involved in campaign work. We haven't heard from Rob Brascio. You're not on, Rob. Okay. So what I'd like to do with your gracious granting me that opportunity is to go through each of the sections, ask whoever is reporting out on each one to give us maybe one positive and one negative, or two positives and two negatives, something that kind of gives people a sense of your discussion. I want to end up here with things that some decent majority of the group would like us to continue to pursue. Whether you want to make that recommendation or not, but that's a recommendation for the whole group, and they may ask questions about that thing. So we're going to have to go a little bit quickly so we can not run totally over our time. So can we start with reporting and transparency? Who's reporting?
Positive.
That's me.
Okay, so the first one on the list was expedited green reporting, 48-hour reporting. This was a bill that Secretary of State's office actually introduced last session, yeah. So that's one of the reasons it's on the top. A positive and a negative?
Positive was it does get information out sooner to the public, which is a value that we do believe in. We were concerned about enforcing the policy and the impact it had on smaller campaigns. On smaller campaigns. Like, what impact would that have on grassroots and volunteer treasurers?
There's strong feelings on either side of that. Group as a whole, have any questions for the group before you just sense of the group that nobody's saying recording this as your vote? It's really a vote of should we explore that further as the potential part of our.
Sorry if I missed it. Is this 48-hour reporting for everything? What are the parameters around this?
I believe it was just for, it was in the final 2 weeks or week of the election, and it's only for larger donations.
I would pose that we ought to have evenly applied reporting timeframes for all contributions.
The principal of yours, are there others who think we ought to continue to look at this?
Justin, are you talking about, like, were you mentioning in-kind stuff, or is that part of the issue?
I would include in-kind as well, absolutely.
If you included in-kinds in all contributions, would that part get you?
Keep up and closer to the mic.
Yeah, pull the mics to you guys.
So we're. This is Dan and Justin. I are just
taken
having
a position that unequal application of based on the size of a contribution is not something that he would favor.
Or is it the size of the contribution or the type of contribution?
Both.
So okay.
I would encourage the group, you know, consistent with our principles from the start, to apply new rules or enhanced rules evenly. And so to Rep. Rayfield's point, our group talked about. Well, what about in-kind contributions? My personal belief is they're underreported. I would love to see in-kind and cash contributions reported more frequently, but without discriminating based on either dollar amount or who it comes from or who it's spent by.
So could I say there is interest in more frequent reporting, particularly at the end? Cautionary thing would be to try to make sure it has an equal application. I'm not saying that has to be your position, but is it still worth exploring more frequent reporting at the end, given that there may be some objections?
Worth exploring. This is Brad. I am much more in favor of it being about, you know, we're talking about influence, about being about larger corporations, particularly for grassroots campaigns with multiple very small donations. Compliance is no small task, including pursuing any missing information. I think a threshold is actually reasonable and fair when we're concerned about influence and knowing the bookkeeping and tracking and other duties. When you go down into the smallest donations, it's truly an unfair penalty on folks who are really trying to do grassroots campaigns.
And to Representative Hannibal.
One of my concerns in this regard is I think in-kind contributions, there tends to be a lot of laxness in reporting them. They come in often very late, often after the election. A lot of those things pour in, and so people don't have that awareness at the time when voting occurs.
I can say for Common Cause that we would definitely want to consider and continue the conversation around increased reporting towards the end of the election, and we feel it would be fine to have increased reporting for just larger contributions, since that addresses voters' concerns about undue influence.
And I would disagree with that. I think in Oregon, the undue influence doesn't come from single large contributions. It comes from multiple coordinated small contributions, and we need to be realistic about our landscape here instead of the national landscape.
It can still be an act. Well, so, we don't have to get into it.
I want to make sure that we move on, and we're not going to have to argue through the particulars of something. Is there interest in something that would require more frequent contributions, particularly towards the end of the session?
Yes.
As end
yes.
of campaign.
So the only thing I would say is we've already got the 7-day reporting, and so from going 7-day to 48, is this, does that increase actually provide a result that is tangible, that really changes how elections, you know, that is meaningful for the public? And I don't know if I'm necessarily there that, you know, that would make that type of difference, but I don't know.
Potential for further discussion and understanding that there are variables in there that will make a difference as to people's ability to support it. Mm. Well, it's already transaction floor.
Our committee felt that there we had concerns about the burden that places on campaigns, and we didn't really feel that it met the concerns that voters have about the influence of big money. So we didn't feel it was necessary to continue to explore that idea.
Okay. I know we have at least one member who has expressed support for that, but okay, no real excitement about that. Increasing the $100 transaction floor, moving it up to 200 or 250 or 1,000 or whatever, so that you eliminate detailed reporting on donations unless it get to a higher level.
Yeah, our group felt that, you know, the limit should be to consider the burden it has on grassroots campaigns. We should be reviewing it. We didn't come to any kind of conclusion about a firm number, though. So I think there's interest in continuing to explore that idea.
Looking around the table, anybody else at least willing to consider? Okay.
750 increase. No, this is the.
I thought we were saying we floor really mostly didn't want to
detailed reporting.
Yeah, I'm not interested in
increasing the $100 transaction floor.
No.
Yeah, I'm personally not interested in doing.
Yeah, I think we felt that the return of value on that particular issue was de minimis.
Yeah.
Okay.
Trade for something else might be useful.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. That was the conversation.
So that's along that same line, increasing the $750 floor for individual candidates, so the reporting doesn't kick in until a higher dollar threshold amount is reached.
Daniel.
Yeah, I think on that one we felt, you know, that should be something we could consider because we talked about the issue of the voters pamphlet. So that would be one that we would be interested in continuing to review.
So that's, yeah, voters pamphlet costs in and of itself puts you up over that.
Voters pamphlet costs. One comment on that? Maybe we could modify that to say lower the floor to $100 in exchange for not requiring you to file a PAC, but if you file a voter's pamphlet statement, we could make it excluded because you already pay, like, who pays for it's basically filed with the government agency. You could just exclude the voter's pamphlet statement from.
And Seth's comment is like spot on, because if you look at our goals of improving public perception, if we increase from $750, we don't help with the perception issue. But if you take Seth's suggestions, we actually address the same concern and meet the interests while maintaining the perception. So I think great idea.
I mean, it just seems to me part of the discussion around this has been, I think it hasn't been increased for a long time. And even just in terms of inflation generally, it seems like it might be worth addressing that threshold, whether it should be $100. I mean, it seems like a very low threshold to me, even if we excluded the voter's pamphlet statement. It should go up, so.
So let's think about
that category of things and perhaps coming back to something that's responsive with those kinds of questions. Again, we're not going to necessarily bring back a final product that you have to vote on up or down. We'll have some more opportunity to tweak at the time. Has the elements that were in House Bill 3552, and I'm sorry, I know there was more to it, but major thing was sort of identifying donors specifically. So
I think on 3552, we felt that it could be considered at a future date, but now we wanted to focus. I didn't think we felt it was necessary for immediate conversation.
So some potential in there of that would be like to reveal individual donors, but not a feeling. Well, I wanted to.
I like the idea.
Talk about what the downsides were.
So it wasn't so much the identifying individual donors as it was identifying pass-through donations. And so when organizations pass money from point A to point B to a campaign to avoid disclosure. I think there's value there, but it was kind of a very complex bill. I think people felt that, while there's value, immediately we want to talk about some other concerns that are being raised. And so I'm trying to report our subcommittee accurately.
I think that's right. I think that we don't disagree that the intent of the bill is good to identify, pass-throughs and donors. But given what we're trying to do here, I think today or in the short term for this session, it may have been a big lift to try and include this as a major element. So I think in general, we expressed the idea that identifying actual donors is a very good idea. Whether this complicated, we just, in 10 minutes, we had a hard time dissecting this complicated bill.
All of the different pieces involved with it.
So I like this idea because it gets to the dark money and foreign contributions problem. And so we need to look into it further, but it's certainly a difficult thing to talk about.
One of our questions was on the foreign one, maybe we're speaking out of turn, but we thought that this would be a better solution than the one we were looking at.
Right, we were looking at the prohibition about foreign corporations donating to Oregon campaigns. We thought disclosure was probably more important than prohibition. But there's no provision about foreign contributions in Oregon law, whereas there is in federal law. That's sort of my summary of that one point on our list anyway.
Could I perhaps accurately, just for our own reporting, say that there is interest and understanding about and addressing the question of pass-throughs. There's a recognition of the complexity of that you kind of have to spend a whole good period of time evaluating what various options might be, and that
yes.
might be more complex than we might be ready for the next session. But I do want us to ultimately have a report that acknowledges the kind of important things that people so I'd like to have that somewhere in there, but we won't necessarily spend each time on it. So then the identification of source of communications piece.
Yeah, I guess we thought there was value in requiring disclaimers on ads, but I just wanted some clarification. Well, I think we were all asking for clarification on the constitutionality of this, because I think what your original email said was these are discussions about things that could pass by statute without a constitutional amendment. And so I think there's a lot of support for the idea of disclaimers, but clarifying on whether this version itself could be passed by statute. Is that accurate?
Yes.
I think there was a question too, and there is a possibility in that of thinking about it as a reporting thing as opposed to putting it on a required officer publication person. Of it versus reporting. That was the only kind of gap or wedge I thought that there might be, that you could have some kind of reporting around specific pieces that,
And I can say as common cause that
we definitely support disclaimer requirements, and we like to have a firm and clear idea about whether that's something we could move via statute. I know we had some initial conversations on our last task force meeting, and I think just asking for a review of that would be really important.
Review of the Attorney General's opinion? Mm-hmm. Yes, I'd like to see that too. So when we get back to the constitutional amendment that we proposed, we should circle back to this idea as well as maybe an additional element in a constitutional amendment. Okay, good.
Yeah, I think this is an important issue. I think we do a real disservice when we allow anonymous campaign materials. People ought to be, they have the right to say what they wish to say, but I think they have the responsibility to acknowledge that they're saying it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and we do believe that there are ways to pass it by statute, too.
Yeah.
I think it'd be good for the task force to continue to explore this idea.
So creating a public education program around OSTAR. People may be able to find information, but they may not know how or that it's there.
I think we didn't feel that this was a hugely necessary requirement to take on. I think people felt that there's not a lot of opposition to it, but also does it really meet what voters are asking for when they ask us to put this task force together.
Can I just add something?
Sure, thank you.
I think one of the things that most people ask for is this system. When we talk to young voters, we hear that they wish that there was a system where they could track big corporations or big companies' donations. When we often tell them that there is this system, they are really surprised to learn about this system. Then when we try to explain how to use this system, they are often really confused by the process and frustrated. We think that encouraging...
Can you folks speak up, please?
Yeah, Nick.
Sorry, Brad. We encourage folks to share information about that system, and our microphone is only so big. So that was the idea of from the bus project, is encouraging folks to understand how to use this system and the existing system in place to help with the public perception issues. And I think it goes back to some of the strong value statements that we had at the beginning of the campaign task force, where it gets more people involved in the system, more people feel frustrated about the existing system and lack of transparency. If we provide education to the existing system, we feel like more people will be excited to be involved.
To repeat for folks on the phone, Nikki's making a couple of different points. One is that in their work with folks who are registering to vote and beginning voters, they wish there were ways to track who was giving money to people and who was responsible for money. When they tell them there is such a system in OSTAR, then they try to use it. They may be confused by it, or it's not necessarily an easy access thing, and that our goal around participation may be enhanced if, and it certainly wouldn't take legislation, but it is something that certainly the Secretary of State's office could take as a recommendation and folks could work together on to make our current reporting system maybe only doing so much good. The experts know how to use it, and everybody else doesn't. Seth.
So I concur with Nikki, but I also think that OSTAR could be improved to make it.
We also touched on that.
Yeah.
I just threw my name tag on the floor. I'm done. No.
The public education component would probably be weak if people went to this website and then couldn't really do anything, and it could be something as simple as just look at like the Center for Responsive Politics and other places where they have breakdowns and see who the major ones are, and just make it a lot more user-friendly, web 2.0-ish. This the Oracle form system is just terrible.
And Seth, our group actually discussed this about how right now we use the example of AT&T. If you search for AT&T and you put ATT, it will bring up a different transaction than AT&T. So having a smarter database is something that our group discussed that we'll talk about, but I definitely agree with that.
I do feel like there is interest in exploring those things. That isn't a huge legislative lift, but it might be a budget lift.
support, but something
we solved that problem for you as well. Representative Rayfield's bill is going to take 2% of the Oracle free consulting work to improve Oristar's search feature.
Folks on the phone hear that? We're going to benefit from the Oracle settlement and get a whole lot of stuff done.
I don't think we got much out of that.
Removing the requirement to report employer and occupation information. Is there a good thing and a bad thing?
I think our committee felt that there wasn't a lot of strong support for that suggestion.
Is there a good thing?
I'll tell
what the good thing is.
Yeah.
The good thing is that it would preserve some people's privacy, and it would avoid the unwarranted inferences that people's employers have something to do with their donations, or that, you know, that people's donations reflect their employers' positions.
I concur with Kyle.
So there are privacy issues involved, and there's the potential inferences that are inappropriate to make, and the downsides that folks had. Removing a reporting requirement being a hard lift to make when you're supposed to be reforming. I mean, I'm just looking at the political.
go ahead.
I was just going to say that I think we had strong opposition to this proposal the first time we considered it, and I think Kyle should get the persistence for continuing to put it in front of the group. But I do think it reduces disclosure and transparency. I don't think there's strong support for it.
I don't disagree with that, but I think it improves transparency by removing false information. It does create a false presumption in the reader's mind that this employer directed that contribution in some fashion. So what I would put on the table as an alternate, if we're going to preserve this, let's talk about the affiliations that really do have the opportunity to influence political choice and supplement employer and occupation with other factors like labor union membership, other things like that. Employers, as you know, really have almost no ability to communicate political issues in the workplace, and that's very different with labor organization membership. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. Just saying if we want to talk about transparency, let's talk about transparency.
So do I sense a majority view to pursue this issue at some additional?
I mean, Common Cause doesn't feel that voters sent us here to remove transparency requirements.
What about supplementing it by adding other affiliations?
I mean, that's something we could explore, but that's not the suggestion right here.
That's what I just put on the table.
So I like your idea. I think it's useful to have a more generalized disclosure. You're right, employer relationships are not the only thing that can influence the use of donations. So,
board memberships.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, increased disclosure might help in that area. From other kinds of relationships that might be used for even multiple relationships.
It'd be interesting getting through our list. I'm happy to put up there, thinking about if there are expanded ways to do that. Let's go ahead.
Well, I don't want to detain us too much, but I remember the first time I filled that out, and how uncomfortable for some reason I felt. I didn't see why where I worked or what I did had any influence on my contribution, and I still think it's a very inappropriate question to ask. And I think it constrains people's response. And this was years ago before I was in public office.
I think it was actually a fad at the time this was passed.
Yeah, and I just don't know why we would do that to people.
Brad?
Gene, at the time this was passed, it was because of concerns that may not be relevant anymore, which were employers who were funneling contributions through individuals.
Oh.
And I think our challenge is, when we talk about optics, there's some things that we've said, look, we should do this. This may not fix everything, but it'll improve people's confidence. I think if we step backwards on this point, we may have a strong rationale. We may be able to challenge the assumptions that it drives. But honestly, I think the public optics will be, we're reducing transparency. So I think that's the challenge for this kind of a commission. Yep. I think if we go backwards on this point, people will see it as backwards and undermine kind of our goal. So it's something the public's used to. It's something that donors, I think, have
well, it's a federal
working assumption in the system.
It's a federal thing, so people are doing
better in other places.
Yeah. Happy to explore whether any other state or other folks have added to that or made other kinds of disclosure work around just to see if there is an option there that.
But
that
how kind tall of you are, what type of car you drive.
That'd be relevant.
Just weird stuff.
And that's my
well, and lawyer should
if
be
we,
on there.
If we start expanding,
if you're not one.
If we start expanding the affiliations, do I have to list all 10 professional organizations I belong to?
I don't know.
Probably.
Well, I think the best place to be would to see is there somewhere else where somebody has done something in addition to employer and occupation, and I'm happy to take at least that step and come back.
It gets
to
invasive
that.
Quickly.
Well, it does.
And the restriction of contribution reporting requirements to those promoting actual electioneering it started, I think, in a pass-through kind of thing, and looking at those 501c4s, and they are doing a lot of things. And so, if you were going to ID, anyway, somebody else explain it or go.
You want to describe what you're talking about?
Yeah, I guess I'll. Well, do we want to describe what it's about or what our recommendation is?
Well, as quickly as we can, just to make sure people know what we're talking about.
Okay, so this came about because in Washington State there was an issue that they had contribution limits, and there was a lawsuit fought over whether a recall committee who was getting pro bono legal assistance in a federal civil rights case would be limited from getting that assistance because they were getting that as an in-kind contribution. So the thinking was that we should not consider something like pro bono legal assistance not related to your electioneering work as a political contribution because it wasn't part of your political work. So I wanted to look at the definition of what a contribution is and try to tether that to your campaigning activity and not to unrelated things you might be doing that would get
so
swept up into
the system. So we do require expenditures by committees to be reported, and some of those are rent, and some of those are campaign, and some of those are legal services. So, could we hear what the group's consensus was?
And our consensus was, or I understand where that's coming from, but some of us also felt that money is fungible, and it's there are increasing ways that people can avoid reporting requirements and still participate in campaigning. And so, I don't think we actually reached a consensus on whether or not it was right to move forward with conversation at this time.
I just want to add one little quick point on that. Volunteer labor is not required to be reported in Oregon, so something like that, as long as it wasn't being paid for someone else to do that labor for them, would be fine. And they think, I don't know if in that case they were actually being paid by some entity to, but I would want to see that if it were the case, it was not volunteer.
In that particular case, it was pro bono legal aid, but it was from a large organization that gets donations to fund its activity.
Yeah, that I think should be still disclosed, clearly.
I'm not going to put on the list for the moment until somebody comes up and tackles me. a two-tiered penalty system, thinking about intentional versus accidental reporting errors.
And our group felt that, we weren't sure about two-tiered penalty system, but we do think intent should be really considered in how penalties are assessed.
Agree with intention.
Yeah. And just to tease it out a little bit more, I think it could be difficult to determine intent, what is an honest mistake, but we did discuss that it seems like right now the valid reasons for failing to report timely are very limited, and it's almost like the treasurer has to die, or somebody cited an example of somebody having a heart attack and being hospitalized was not considered a valid reason for not reporting, so that maybe we need to look at expanding the exceptions to being fined. And
so Brenda will probably correct me or maybe can express it better, but the way I have been, you know, I even before I got this position, sort of understood it to be is that the in order to limit, to make sure that it is reporting violations that we're after and not intentional fraudulent withholding of information sort of things, it all needed to be treated the same. And it simply missed that deadline or misreported at that point, and so it's an assessment against your, you know, hopefully it's you're not at zero and you've got money to pay out of your campaign account to pay the fine. That if we went to a more, what was the motive and, you know, was there intent involved, that would require another whole level of investigation that I think the legislature didn't really want to pay for. That is a weakness. It is a challenge that I think people have. And I don't know if the exceptions are as limited as Diane says, but.
Well, there is an exception for medical. If you provide documentation that there is a medical issue of the delay of the reporting, that is a mitigating circumstance.
Brenda's reporting for the folks on the phone that there is a medical exception for, but it does require documentation. It does have to relate to the time. I mean, it's a mitigating circumstance that it is. But do folks feel like evaluating the current statutes on mitigation and or adding, intent to deceive or some kind of, you know, thing like that, are things worth exploring by the group?
Gene, in the simplest way, this is Brad. I'm glad there's that medical exemption. I don't have the exact language in mind, but there are clearly other instances where best faith efforts would be preferably not punished, but again, recognizing you don't really have an ability to increase enforcement funding. The two concepts we deal with at the federal level, really there's kind of two simple versions that allows the FEC some maneuvering room. One is through rulemaking and through offered opinions, safe harbors. In other words, for occupation employer, they specifically say, if you've done this and this, then you've made a best faith effort, and that's good enough for us. And then secondly, interestingly, in this day and age, I think the number one thing most are most concerned about is that something happens to their computer or that something happens to online systems. And it seems that now, since both parties have suffered national hacks, I know that the biggest echo was in the finance division, but the second biggest echo was in the compliance division, worries that data was manipulated outside of their control, and that there's nothing really written to address that kind of consideration when folks are making good faith efforts to be compliant. So again, it's probably a down the road, but I think it's going to be, it may quickly overtake any kind of medical considerations.
Kyle.
I wanted to add that part of the impetus for this was that if penalties are large and there aren't a lot of safe harbors or exemptions and intent doesn't matter, then who in their right mind would ever want to be a volunteer treasurer? We want to encourage more people to be able to get into stuff like this.
So this penalty part was also covered in our next series of questions that we had, and we'll be reporting. I think Daniel will be reporting a general statement that maybe I'm not going to expand on it too much, but all the penalty statutory regulations should probably be reviewed with some criteria.
Could I generally conclude, again, somebody just tackle me, that as a reform measure, the accidental problems versus intent might not be a first priority to take up. That is a live issue that folks would, from various states, might like to discuss with Secretary of State's office and others down
down the line. When you get to your penalties part, maybe we put something a little bit different up there. I'm going on eyes as opposed to people, you know, nodding their heads, so it's okay to say it's just not at all.
I agree. It's not a core
issue. Of the group as opposed to sense of individuals,
we
if I can, if I can
get it. Them down.
Okay. So if we... Do we want to move to enforcement and penalties since we're on that subject?
Yeah.
And that would we'll skip down to enforcement and penalties and see where we are. First one, establish a requirement that campaigns respond in 30 days. I'll be quite honest with you, we're having this drafted. Just because, you know, not to say whether it'll be introduced or not, that will be perhaps up to the secretary, but it is an interest of ours that it is a challenge when we can request responses within 30 days, but if people choose to ignore our request for additional information, we don't really have any tools to make them respond and give us the... So
this is our same group, but I'm reporting on this one. So you'll be happy to hear that the group thought it was reasonable to have a timeline and that the point was made that there is a federal timeline that I think is similar or the same. And that so we felt that this met our goals. And I think the one thing that the group said is that we think it should be clarified because this is phrased as campaigns respond, that this should apply to all reporting entities.
Which topic are we on?
We thought campaigns might sound like just candidate campaigns. Or
is there a downside?
I don't think we had a downside. Did
we have
no.
No.
Is this like supposed to be subpoena power? Or like what is...
That's how we interpreted it.
Yes,
they already
that.
Have subpoena power. There's just no enforcement mechanism if someone doesn't comply. So, and my bill actually addresses that, but we can get to that.
So how does the Fifth Amendment play into something like this? Is that...
Well, you're not asking people... like,
Rob's going to do a dissertation for us.
No. I mean, I was going to say
I was going to say that I think the downside that was briefly discussed was nuisance complaints.
Yep.
That is a possibility.
We discussed that as well. You could tie up a campaign in the last 2-3 weeks of a campaign with complaints like this, so we need to be cautious.
Yes.
But, so there's no Fifth Amendment problem with anything like here?
You always have a Fifth Amendment, right?
I mean,
okay, so
you're required to report anyway, right? So
you can elect not to. You could get penalties imposed on you, civil penalties, but at least you protect your Fifth Amendment criminal rights.
But respond, it seems.
Hey.
Take the penalty.
Okay, let's move on. How about jacking up those penalties?
So our group thought it was worthwhile to look at the penalties, but we made the point that the penalties, just across the board, increasing all penalties may not be the best approach, that the penalties ought to be rationally related to the violation, and so we think it's worth reviewing the penalties and maybe increasing some, but not necessarily all of them.
And to fall back on my Fifth Amendment criminal background, a couple of things we talked about were when sizing up the penalties or assessing or establishing the range, then deterrence should be an issue and intent should be an issue at least, among other things. At least that's what I said.
Shifting away from complaint-driven systems to one where Elections Division reviews all random filings and backup documentation.
So we interpreted this as possibly returning to something we used to do, which was spot checks on transactions. That was repealed by legislation, and our group thought that it was reasonable to do some sort of auditing of what people are reporting, and that spot checks could be a good way of doing that. And I suppose the downside that we discussed was that if you tried to require monitoring of every transaction, it could increase bureaucracy, workload on the agency, or that you, I think somebody suggested that maybe we weren't going to turn up a lot of violations this way.
And that was the history at the time that the legislation went through not to do it, is they described the binders upon binders upon binders that they had of
and nothing ever came of it.
And that very little, if any, anything came of, or that people even came to review to second guess or to pass judgment on the elections division. There's also been talk, and Representative Rafo may want to talk about his ideas, and obviously we need to make room for an appropriate agency, what it would take to do that, and resource-wise, and what the payoff would be at the other end. But I'm going to kind of frame this in my own mind: is there a better way than what was that earlier practice that was so frustrating and didn't come up with anything that the legislature actually repealed it? So
but now with ORSTAR, the system, if you know, what the pitfalls are that people are falling into, the system could spot check and pull out discrepancies if you required a bank statement for what amount of money you have in the bank at the time of your reporting. The system could automatically, before, when we were doing the auditing, it was all paper. All the reports were paper, everything, and somebody had to peer over them. You didn't have the ability of a system to go in and pull out certain ones periodically to look at what's going on.
To automate the process.
So we could look at whether or not there are new, more electronically based ways to.
Yes.
Good point.
And I think that idea of trying to reconcile, I mean, I don't think anybody is required to produce bank statements, are they? Or do you guys sometimes ask for those?
We can ask for it if we are investigating a complaint. We can ask for documentation.
Spot checks rather than random complaints.
I mean, my recollection of when this was repealed was that there had been a really big backlog of reviewing and asking for this information, so that campaigns weren't getting asked about a specific transaction until a long time after it had been filed. And so people were really frustrated that nothing was coming of this. Plus, you had to go back, 6 months or a year, and produce documentation for something that you had filed so long ago.
Gone.
But I think that Margie's point, about now with ORSTAR, you could just, when you get that report out that says your transaction doesn't have any mistakes in it, you could just ask for it at that point.
I just want to make, this is just about, is it on the list for some further perusal? And I'm sensing that people have an interest in exploring whether there's understanding that it could be a laborious process that came to nothing, or are there more effective ways for it to happen? So,
this is Brad. We have a fairly rigorous spot check system, and it's called Opponents. My primary concern, Gene, and not to ask for an answer now, would be that your office has the resources to effectively pursue those complaints that are brought forward quite naturally by the participants in the system. That doesn't mean something like this wouldn't be appropriate, or there may not be some automated way to do it, but honestly, my first concern would be that you have the resources to effectively address the concerns that are brought forward by the public scrutiny.
So it stays on the list for some future, again, unless I'm tackled. Senator Boquist, welcome. I'm sorry that we're going to just move ahead here, and I think you'll pick up on sort of what we're
I'll pick up quickly. The governor outranked you. Sorry.
I say to school children all the time when I meet with them, the governor appointed me, but she's not my boss.
She can't.
It's the glory of the cast of her constitutional officer.
I love that.
Increased penalty for contribution reported as an IE when in fact it's determined to be an in-kind contribution because of coordination. This may be something also that Representative Rayfield's package is addressing, so we might want to but be interested in the pros and cons that you guys discussed.
Well, I think our group felt this would be part of the discussion about increasing penalties overall, and so maybe this will get addressed in the report out from the other group.
So this particular idea would depend on beefing up the definition of coordination. And California Fair Campaign Practices Commission recently put out a set of rules that would be interesting for us to look at.
I did have those in the folder. I think I did print them out. Didn't do a big review of them, but that may be...
I don't really see this being too important until we actually make it a distinction between the two legally, like a serious distinction. Like right now, there's no limit on either case. So why would somebody lie about that?
Great question.
Yep.
You say that meaning they do anyway, and so why are they, or that they don't?
I think there's, this goes back to our very first meeting when we're talking about the whack-a-mole concept. If you do certain reforms, it causes independent expenditures to become more important. I would agree with Seth. Today in Oregon, IEs are useless unless you're trying to be nefarious, in which case we ought to enhance penalty for it.
Yeah, well, it becomes much more important if we have contribution limits.
If we have contribution limits or restrictions on who can give, IEs will explode, absolutely.
Yeah.
So I would support enhancing the penalties. Yeah. It's a pretty narrow issue, though, and I think the Senator was right. We ought to look at this holistically with all of the penalties and tailor them a little bit better than they are today, perhaps.
So let's go to the new prohibitions. I think that group that Norman will report on, I guess I was part of that discussion, had more interesting challenges in the sense that it was kind of different kinds of outside things. So making bribery a crime.
Well,
we had a bill. That
bribery is already a crime, at least in the context of trying to influence a public official. But this... I think was in the context of campaign contributions, and you'd probably have to include candidates in the idea of trying to influence as a bribe, and a bribe is some sort of quid pro quo. We thought it was a useful idea in terms of increasing public perception of the integrity of the system, but it also might provide disincentive for people to become candidates if they thought they might be liable for some sort of quid pro quo. And the challenge is really in writing of the particular definition of what that quid pro quo is. So it's probably useful to consider it, but it's not a core issue for us, I think. As far as the next bullet, if you're ready to move on.
Okay. So if there are questions about that, and certainly, Senator Roberts, if you wanted to speak to the rationale of the difference.
I just want to correct your the term quid pro quo here you're using here. It is illegal for the two representatives and the two senators here to take a personal gain for some event. There is a legal opinion, and now it's being rewritten, which is a massive expansion with the McConnell versus the United States ruling, that will tell you that other than our good ethical and moral conduct between the two senators here, at least I'll talk to the Senate side because we have slightly different rules on the House side, is that we don't take what you would call bribes or the normal person's name bribes. However, example A is as if corporation, the Acme Corporation, legally walks into my office in the middle of session and says, I want you to sponsor this bill with one of your priority bills, and I want you to vote for this bill, and I will give you a $100,000 donation to your campaign. As long as I put it in OrStar, it is perfectly legal in the state of Oregon.
Yeah, but that's what I was trying to get at as right. well. Maybe I didn't make myself clear.
Yeah, so there is some conduct that most people would think is bribery or unethical that is perfectly legal, and now I don't even know the answer to that because, once again, like campaign finance reform, McDonnell versus the U.S. has expanded that definition so wide now, I don't even know what it is. Yeah. Now, there are Senate rules and House rules and Capital Club rules that say you can't take donations, so on and so forth like that, but we do have a very wide open system.
But nothing in statute.
But yeah. Nothing in statute.
Yeah, I agree. And
considering the
I think our only point
nothing
was
in statute considering a campaign contribution to be the equivalent of personal gain
right, exactly.
that you might have for yeah. that. So the question is that something people want to explore?
Our answer was yes.
I would love to explore that.
For the record, I am sponsoring a bill on that topic again, too. Making it statutorily illegal to do that.
Okay, well, I don't want to influence your opinion on this, but I would support that.
Okay, prohibition on receipt of donations during the legislative session.
So there is currently rules in the House about this prohibition, but not in the Senate. This would be the idea of adding that to as a statute, and we thought it was a useful idea to pursue further not just donation but solicitation of donation maybe is could be included as well.
As well or instead of.
Yeah, and sort of promises to make a donation at another time. Sort of all that during session would be included in this idea. Including not just the legislators, but also maybe their challengers in the same prohibition would be a useful idea. And then there's the problem, the special problem of special sessions. If you had a special session in August before a campaign, would that also be included in this prohibition? But all those are useful things to think about in the context of this. And we thought, yes, go ahead and discuss this.
Yeah, so isn't there also a requirement that the governor can't take, that the governor cannot take contributions during the legislative session or 30 days after till all the bills are signed? Because when we run a candidate, they can fundraise, but the governor can't. And so what happens to your Secretary of State, your treasurer, during that session too, or are you only talking about the House and the Senate?
Well, those are all things that we'd have to look at.
Good point.
I don't think, I mean, Brenda can correct me, but I don't think there's any statute that prohibits taking contributions by any candidate or elected official. It's just reporting requirements that
you have to report them within a certain period of time.
You might want to check with the governor.
And I thought that there was such a law, and that it was overturned by some opinion that it was unconstitutional, right?
Oh, okay.
Well, I mean, I think it's unclear. Are you talking about just a rule that the legislature adopts for itself, or like an actual statute they pass? Because when you have to,
this is a statute.
This
is a good question of it, might we want to have on our list, and it's a big might at this point, something that talks about making a statutory prohibition on in-session solicitation or.
Are we allowed to do that because we don't have a constitutional authorization to ban donations?
Good question.
All good questions.
In terms of the principles we're trying to achieve,
we struck down.
Possible,
right.
Or that's something we want to explore.
Governor, I guess it's unconstitutional. Because it was enforced.
Certainly, will look at it. We can bring you the history, but I don't want to do a big research of the history. It really isn't of interest to folks to kind of, put that kind of thing on the table. I mean, I can certainly understand public perception issues if there are stronger measures that keep them from talking about their fundraising during the course of session. I could also see that being, how could it be completely fair? Could it be completely across the board? Do we have the reach? But is it worth examining?
A quick question for Senator Boqvist. Does your proposed bill that you had discussed, does that impose a criminal penalty, or is it just a civil regulation?
No, it's criminal.
Okay. Class C felony.
That was why I couldn't get it through. It's fairly stiff. Right?
The regular bribery is Class B felony.
So is there interest in having an in-session connection of some kind explored? Having to do it as long as...
Yeah.
No.
Okay. I'm going to keep it on the list.
The only thing to keep in mind is that you can be recalled during the middle of a session, and in that type of a situation, you might have an election which you would have to defend, and so you might want to put an exception in there, just kind of an oddity to note.
It certainly came up when they had the first special session that served as the interim session, and there was all kinds of statewide elections going on, and everybody, it was an issue, but that you're not supported is fine. And then the foreign corporations issue.
Foreign corporations, it's really any foreign entity, not just corporations. And we thought it would be useful to have such a prohibition in Oregon statute. It's already in federal statute, but there's nothing in Oregon statute about it. But it's probably better approach through disclosure laws and very fine. You have to make sure you have a good definition of what foreign is, because as a Oregon registered company that happens to be controlled by foreign owners, is that a foreign donation or not? And that, so there's some detail here that we have to consider, but it's useful to consider this in the longer term, particularly together with disclosure laws of dark money and foreign contributions are sort of the same problem of getting to the true source of the donations that are made in Oregon campaigns.
Can we just look at what the federal regulations are and how they, FEC's been dealing with it for a long time, and see if we couldn't just recommend something similar? We know that's proven. And it stands up.
I understand this
problem.
Yeah, I understand they're having issues right now because of the dark money problem, period.
And as you may know, this became news locally because a company was found to have given, or a company owner was found to have given to a good number of folks, and there's nothing expressed in our state election law that prohibits that, even though they're prohibited from, by federal law, from giving, and so there's sort of no way for us to reach. Did have the same complication, and there was a company formed in Oregon, registered in Oregon with an Oregon owner that subsequently had been had been bought by, or bit greater investment from out of the country. So at what point do you become a foreign corporation? At any rate, it was suggested that we may want to take that up, whether we think that's a good problem to address.
One thing to look at with that is that we already do have an interesting law called the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act at the federal level that says that our corporations interfering with foreign elections run into issues, like legally. So maybe we can look at that.
And
I'm sorry, different question. How much longer do you think we're going to go? I have an 11:30 task force.
Oh, I'm sorry. I hoped that we had until 12 when I saw that folks were early into their discussion. We do have very quickly three things on ethics laws and Representative Rayfield's measures. And we're just list building at this point, Representative Kentner. So if you feel like you need to go, probably people won't do something that's going to bind you to anything terrible.
We all have a hard time doing it.
It is a good opportunity to bind him to something terrible.
So my comment was in line, I think, with Norm's. Focusing on corporations, I think it's good political buzzword, but that's not the issue in Oregon. It's foreign individuals, entities, whatever we might do. Using the term foreign corporation also, I think, is that's a legal term in Oregon. Intel is a foreign corporation. So we got to be careful with the wording that we're using here. I would fully endorse a blanket prohibition on outside of the U.S. money coming into Oregon politics, including individuals.
Is that something that people want?
I think we do.
Yes.
Yes.
No.
Yeah. Yell out and maybe you win.
Okay. We had three changes to ethics laws, and we did have a little discussion about whether that was within the purview of this group, but at the same time, if there's some strong feelings about them, we should get them on the list.
So the first one was about elected officials identifying contributors in ethics filings, presumably in, say, the SEI statement of economic interest. And we thought, no, that's not a particularly great idea, and it's redundant with what's in ORSTAR anyway. So that was, we can maybe dispose of that one quickly.
Thank you.
The second one was lobby reports require including information when a lobbyist is staff or member of a PAC board. There's maybe something to this. It's maybe a definitional problem of what sort of influence a lobbyist has on the process of making donations to candidates. And that's really the relationship that we're concerned about, not necessarily that they're serving as a member or staff of a outside PAC. So yeah, the answer is maybe, I guess.
Yeah. Members of the board are already reported through PAC filings. And so the question would be, is a staff person actually, do they have a significant amount of influence on how the donations are allocated? Because that's how it would relate to us, is how those definitions are allocated. And so maybe the question of is, if they're staff, then maybe
was it a good thing
a
or a bad thing that it be revealed? That was the other thing that came
and there
up
is
in
a,
that discussion.
A topic of maybe we use the PAC board filings itself on whether or not they disclose who influences how their money goes about, rather than making the lobbyists do it, other ways to approach it.
Seth, is that accurate that the PAC trustees are public today?
Yeah.
Are you positive?
They're all the board of directors of PACs.
Oh, you don't have to report them all.
No. Yeah, I don't think that's an accurate
don't have to
conclusion.
Them all.
I think it's the officers of a PAC, right?
That's correct.
It's only the officers. So you could have 10 lobbyists on your PAC board without disclosing it. You know, you could be the treasurer and Senator Rosenbaum could be the president and not disclose the rest of the members.
Even realize that. I just put them all down. But
is that an area that folks would like us to look at? Is it important that that connection be visible to the public of folks who are hired to lobby or are hired to as opposed to volunteer?
The increased disclosure that I think our little committee wanted was who was actually making the decisions for that PAC. And if that included a lobbyist, then that was an important disclosure.
I think we agreed with it in principle.
but it needs work.
It's a great question, because at least in my experience, the PAC boards make the decision, and the treasurer has very little role in doing anything other than dispersing funds and filing reports. But yet we disclose the treasurer and not the decision makers.
Right.
And responsible.
What I might do is look and see whether that's something that's regulated by anybody else, or there's a other state that's doing it, something that we wouldn't have to invent from scratch that makes some sense in our context, and bring it back to you.
I would only suggest when you do that, you're going to have to define lobby. Lobby has no good definition. The Ethics Commission is struggling with that right now, because if you're a hired lobbyist, so to speak, you have a report, but if you're the vice president of ACME for government affairs and you're doing internal lobby for the corporation, there's multiple corporations and associations in Oregon that are refusing to register with the Ethics Commission right now, and there's a loophole in the law that allows them to get away with that. Now, Ethics Commission is working on that, and I am working with them to close that loophole, but...
Yeah, and it's a fairly high bar.
I think that we might want to narrow ours with enough things on our list to things that are campaign finance, you know, directly.
I might just say all the decision makers on a PAC board, throw it up, just to not have to define lobbyists.
Yeah. Not connected at all with lobbyists.
Right, that's what we were trying to go after, was that.
Yeah.
Get going to that next
one. The third one was require lobbyists to disclose the bills that the influences. Other states, in fact, do this. And we thought it disclosing before a session about what you're going to be working on is maybe mildly useful, but what you have worked on in the past is also important. So maybe you need to do both. Disclose what you think you're going to be working on and what you have worked on in the past. And it's really topics, not necessarily particular bills. That.
Do you all feel like there's, on this issue, a close enough tie to campaign finance reform that it's something worth looking at? Because we can certainly look at what other states do have. Brad talked about living under somewhat of a, you know, best efforts reporting they did in Montana. It may, you know, it certainly creates more transparency in the system, but I ask if it's something that you...
It's not a core issue maybe for this task force, but it's maybe something that should be talked about further.
Yeah, I like the, you know, so I think there's two different things when we're talking about, you know, the influence of, you know, in our when we're talking about the influence of our political system, there's the campaign side of things, and then there is the legislative side of things, right? And what I would want to know, and I think would be good for the public side, is to be able to see, and I love when Seth talks about, like, websites and, like, visualizing, and he does a great job, and I envision kind of a similar system to how you were kind of talking about Orstar, where you get onto a similar situation, and we have a certain bill number. You get to see all the lobbyists lined up on one side, all the lobbyists lined up on the other side, all of the money that has been paid into each one of these lobbyists, then we can actually see the amount of money that flows into Oregon on a given issue and the folks aligned on both sides, absolute transparency about how policy is created and who's pushing it. That's what I would like the public to be able to easily be able to access. And right now, the current system and the ethics side of things, it is confusing this at best, and I consider myself to be savvy. And so that's what I'd really like to see, is we get the transparency on the campaign side, which leads to the elected officials, but then let's talk about the transparency on what drives the actual bills. So, and I'm actually going to have a bill on this. So, yeah. So, sorry.
Good.
I'm happy to gather for you the information about what happens in other states, but that might be the kind of issue that in our report becomes, you know, the future vision here is that we're able to see both sides, and considering only the campaign finance side without the lobbying doesn't really give the public that, but we didn't dive.
And this really is kind of it's in the Ethics Commission realm. I mean, there is kind of but it is a hybrid type issue.
Are enabling statute or whatever, just was it limited to campaign finance of candidate campaigns, or is it broad enough to include lobbying campaigns? Like, I'm just wondering what are.
And I don't think the statute distinguished.
It did not.
It did not. I think probably the intent was more focused on candidates, but that didn't mean, again, that we would treat unevenly reporting requirements on.
That's up to us. Yeah. Okay.
So I'm going to put lobby disclosure up here just as a information about that. Before we get into, so we can do a time check, before we get to Representative Rayfield's bill, I wanted to just make sure you know that already from our earlier discussion today, a public financing proposal expansion of the tax credit and voluntary agreements are on the list here for additional consideration, understanding there are some strong feelings against, you know, a couple of those things that would clearly be, might end up being, or maybe we come up with just the most magic program and other people think that it's terrific. So I don't want to lose that in the process here. So, Rachel, do you want to report, or you have somebody else?
I'll just quickly run down because I know we're short on time.
We will try to be done by 12.
I'll easily get through it. We went through just the bill. You'll see kind of on the list there are about four things, and I think Ryan in my office kind of those are really one. Very quickly, we determined that kind of the new additional changes to the bill as far as establishing a PAC would create too much friction. I think there was enough for, like, lowering the threshold for a PAC establishment. So if you were going to spend greater than $5,000 in Oregon politics, you know, you should establish a PAC. We can see the money flowing in and out of that. I think at this point that wasn't something that we wanted to go down the road with. One of the things that we all agreed with was closing the cash balance adjustment loophole, so and increasing the penalty on that. So, you know, if you've taken a $10,000 contribution, you forget to log it, and then you let out $9,500 of expenses, and you just don't log that, and then you do a $500 cash balance adjustment, well, then you only have a 10% penalty, so you can kind of wiggle room around stuff like that. And so what we want to do is increase that penalty a little bit higher, and that was a recommendation based on several treasurers who noted that to be a loophole. So we agreed on that. We agreed on increasing, so my original bill, which was increasing penalties to 40%, we all agreed on that. Audits rather than spot checks, which kind of everybody already a little talked about, we agreed on, you know, having the random audits and making sure, as long as there was assurances that they truly were random, and so putting that in there. The other issue, at least my bill, was like funding 2 FTE to the Secretary of State's office and talking, because you can't just say, hey, do this extra stuff without giving the resources, but also understanding that only 2 FTE would limit the amount of type of audits that you would be doing. You're not going to be, we're not auditing 10% of all the accounts out there, right? And this would include, you know, ballot measure PACs. It would also include candidate PACs. So we agreed on that. The other thing we agreed on, kind of what Seth was talking about, is enhancing ORSTAR, which was part of the underlying bill, and to make it more searchable for, like, independent expenditures, where right now there's some ways that you, and I actually really like the kind of all the different things that Seth was talking about, and so, but a real simple fix would be to put some quick search queries on there for independent expenditures, so that way when I search Dan Rayfield, I can see anything that has been spent on Dan Rayfield's behalf, or if I'm a big independent expenditure person, I can see anything that I have spent on all the various different campaigns. And then there's the other component of this, which is kind of the investigation component, which we talked a little bit about under the current bill. If you had Secretary of State had reasonable suspicion that a violation had been committed, kind of that complaint-driven process, you would have the ability to request bank statements, all these things which are already there. However, if someone didn't comply, you could then go to the court and get a writ of mandamus to then force them to comply with this, which is kind of the tool that they do not have right now. And the perfect example is a Speaker Kotek primary in which Secretary of State's office asked for certain documents from potential violators, and they said, no, we're not going to give them to you. And that was what happened.
Actually, they said, we aren't the people that did this. So, a different way of saying no. Right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, what about my request? I still ask for these documents. Well, we aren't the people that's you're saying no, right? I mean, it's basically. I'll leave the editorial for later. We all agreed on the investigation. One of the things that we wanted to make sure in determining whether or not that we avoided kind of the. I guess the bad actors who might want to, you know, allege a complaint to gum up the works, maybe increasing from reasonable suspicion to probable cause. But again, the nice backstop is that if someone did say no, like kind of the Fifth Amendment issue, if you did say no, then you could go to the court who could then look at the facts of the situation and then, which is kind of a backstop, right? So you have an independent, neutral person to then issue the writ at the end of it. So all those ideas we agreed with. The one issue...
Can I ask a quick question? Your reasonable suspicion would be the triggered by a complaint, or even aside from a complaint being filed, but we read about it in the newspaper. That is a really big difference, whether, you know, because we currently respond to complaints that are filed as opposed to look out there for reasonable suspicion.
Clearly it's a workload issue, right? But the bill would give you the authority, right? Yeah, the bill would give you the authority to do whether you learned it through a complaint or whether it was through the newspaper or, you know, rumblings in a hallway, right? So it would just give that authority to be able to conduct it. I mean, the workload issues and other stuff aside, right, that's a whole nother issue, whether you have the ability to do it. When we looked at, like, kind of all of those ideas and whether it complied with the goals, we said it met 3 out of the 5 goals, for the task force. So which the 3 it met: improving public perception of campaigns, elections, and candidates, expanding the opportunity for an informed electorate, and reflecting campaign finance issues here in Oregon. So tried to be quick.
So there were links, if you want to go back and, you know, in the list, because Aaron Smart knows how to do that and I don't, so that you could find the original bill that had gotten got moved with the due pass down to Ways and Means and SAT, so you can see what those pieces are. I would like a chance to go over that again and have and sort of tease out a little bit more discussion of some of those issues. One thing on my mind, and that we may want our elections team to ponder on, as Representative Rayfield has already asked them to do, is it's a workload issue, and that's a big thing. What kinds of resources does the state want to commit to this kind of thing? There's also the sort of the discretionary judgment around reasonable suspicion and where it's appropriate to go down the road for to ask campaigns, and as you said, you know, it's the last minute of the campaign, and, you know, giving our office that authority also means that some judgment has to be exercised about when it's used and when it's not. Does open the door for a whole lot of second guessing, which, I mean, there is a certain advantage to having it been drawn from outside complaint as opposed to, but there's also things that then go unenforced, and there are things that are brought to us that are end up being nothing, you know. So those are,
I think, the general concern of having the investigative ability, or that is, you know, you see a situation where, you know, there was a significant campaign violation, right, but, you know, during an election season. Well, that's something that the electorate should know about, right? I mean, they should be aware of these things. And if you don't have the tools to get that information, the electorate can't be informed on that. I mean, that is an issue, you know, in my mind. You know, and obviously there is always the other side of that, right, which is... does someone try and abuse the system, right, and file a complaint that's not necessary, you know, or that is unfounded? But at the same time, they also can affect candidates where something is where you don't have the resources to pursue it, and they go ahead and send a press release anyway that say, you know, that says that this has been, and it would be nice from the candidate who is a good actor to be able to have the resources to say this complaint was unfounded. Right. And so it kind of goes both ways, which I think would be helpful, because we're going to have people who are going to file these things no matter what, one way or the other, and use them in a political way. So
So how do you
time
get
factors
at the
are
the
also
truth?
At play there too,
yeah.
Because they're filed 2 weeks before the election. No matter how many investigative powers we're going to have, you're not going to clear the air by the time yeah. election rolls around. But anyway,
Dan, did you eliminate the provision then that that entities have to form a PAC if they expend above a certain amount?
So that was something. So we had this initial bill, and then we started. You know, I continued to vet after the session, and that was in talking with the treasurers. That's what they came up with. And one of the big concern was it'd be nice to have if an entity was going to spend greater than X amount of dollars in Oregon. Let's see the money come into Oregon and then flow out.
Right.
In kind of in our group, and it became really apparent there was, you know, some opposition to it, and I wouldn't want to kill an otherwise good bill based on that. One of the things that kind of Justin brought up, we can achieve the same means by enhancing the search capabilities of Orstar, right? Where right now, if you type, and that's where we started using AT&T as an example, where if you typed in AT&T, we'd be able to see all of the money that AT&T gave out during the election cycle or any other entity or individual, which we can do now. It's just a little bit, we can make it easier.
I don't mean to get off on a tangent, but I actually think this is a big loophole in Oregon now, is that you don't, whether you're a union or a corporation of any sort, you don't have to have a PAC in order to contribute. You can just contribute, you know, treasury money or corporate money. And the only way that we ever hear about that is when the receiving end of it reports it. So, and I don't know what other states do about this, but
some do require PACs. I mean,
it's like it should be to me.
You're really talking about two things, though. I mean, it would be one question if we want to require in Oregon contributors to a candidate or a PAC to file that. And I think that's a legitimate question. But the second question that we've kind of leapt to is forming a PAC the correct way to go about that. And I don't think it is. I think a PAC creates a lot of unnecessary work for small campaigns that might be just over the threshold, when if what you're after is figuring out who Standard Insurance Company is giving money to, and you don't think that Rep. Rayfield's reports are good enough, then we ought to talk about that, because I could see that being a system.
I mean, to me, if Standard Insurance Company is going to give money, they should have to report it. That's what I'm saying.
And I'm saying that's a fair conversation. I think requiring entities or individuals to form PACs is a clunky way to get there.
Well, is there another way to make them report it?
Sure, you just require all contributions to candidates or to PACs, something that have to be filed in Orestar.
Could be reported by whoever's making them.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Over some threshold.
By who receives them already.
Exactly, and that's my point.
I mean,
you're making the assumption that the candidate's actual reports aren't sufficient if you want to go there.
So kind of the thought process was, is if generally speaking, I think most people comply with the campaign finance rules, right? There are going to be some exceptions to where that's not always the case, right, where, say, a Standard does give out some money, maybe the candidate doesn't file it. With the auditing that would be in the bill, that would incentivize people to absolutely comply, right? That would be a big issue if you got caught on that. Then on the back end, on the search side, you could then type in Standard and see everyone that they gave money to from, which would have been logged on the candidate PAC side or a petition or, a ballot measure committee, and kind of see it that way. And then, so you'd see all of the money that they were issuing in the state. It would just be searching it in a different way, which gets back to Orstar has to be a little bit more intuitive, right, from a user standpoint.
So then if an organization gave through a general fund, maybe a business, maybe a labor union, maybe a nonprofit, if they gave through a general fund and not through a PAC, could you still go under this process and see who gave to the general fund or what, like where the general fund donations were coming from?
Yeah. You'd be able to see that, you know, Standard gave X amount of dollars, you know, to the, so it, basically if they took money out of their own, you know, business corporation and then gave it to various candidates. I mean, you can do that now a little bit. It's a little wonky, and it's not exactly where I want it to be. But yeah, you can. You'd be able to see that. I think I'm understanding your question.
Because like, I guess what I'm asking is like, if, you know, just as an example, if Sierra Club gives to the PAC, you can go on OrStar and you can click on who all the people who gave the Sierra Club are,
right?
And see where that goes. But if Sierra Club just gives through the organization to the candidate, you can't necessarily do that. You're saying that that would allow your reform would allow me to do that.
No. So, like, for instance, like a corporation, like it's not a like a member, you know, kind of driven situation where they literally have, you know, they set aside in their budget processes what we're going to do for campaigns, and then it gets sent out, right? And so, a corporate, you wouldn't see, for instance, a PAC where, you know, let's say, I'm sorry, let's use a different company. Let's stick with AT&T.
Because as a corporation, can give to anybody they want to in Oregon.
They call it Acme Corporation.
All right, is this? Okay, fine. We'll call it Acme. So, Acme.
They have
would
a bill about anvils
into,
that they're going to list
it, you
on
know,
whatever.
Acme would contribute into a PAC and then distribute it out, which would essentially be no different than if Acme Corporation distributed directly to a candidate, because then you would still be able to search under the transaction subcategory for contributions, type in Acme, and then you would pull all of the money that they gave in the state that was record. I should say that was recorded by the candidate or ballot measure or a petition committee. So it's that's why I say it's a little bit wonkier, right? And so that's kind of, but if you made OrStar a little bit more intuitive for like a non-sophisticated user, us in this room are going to be considered sophisticated, then it would be a little, you would get to that same means. The one thing you wouldn't get, right, and this is something we did talk about, is if you had an organization outside that was contributing directly that had multiple sources into that entity, right? Where a corporation just has its profits, which is the source of its contributions.
Which I think was the benefit of them requiring, any entity to make, they want to make a contribution and do so through a PAC. And that way, like, it's at least in a disclosable format.
I mean, now there's always a way around it, because you could also donate to some out-of-state entity, which then donates into the PAC, which then looks like a single source, which then goes out here. So you know, there's always a way to manipulate it, right? But the intent, I like the intent.
So we really do need to cut ourselves off here, but we do need to think about next steps. I think that with some of Aaron's help and with my team's help, we can do a lot to pull together some thoughts on these topics that are still alive back to you all. I also would not mind at all having a little bit of help with that, and might like if there are particular issues, and I think probably the public financing is one, perhaps a mid-time meeting that Representative Rayfield was willing to hold. As long as we don't have a majority of the group at any one discussion, we could have a little, you know, some interim work done so that we're a little bit further along the line in terms of answering some questions in October. Perhaps what I would ask you all to do after this meeting is to let me know if there are particular areas that you would like to make sure that whatever comes forward to this group as a possible outline of how to address the issue, if you've got something that you'd like to have, you know, to participate in a discussion about that, you let me know, and there might be two or three opportunities for that to happen. I will have to cut it off, limit this to numbers at some point, because we don't want to have a public meeting that we didn't have a public meeting on, but I'm absolutely happy to take some help. And if there are particular areas, which I think some folks, particularly around public finance, might be interested in, that they want to help be put together, what might be a relevant way to approach the issue. It's still starting from scratch with the group. It's not coming forward as this is how to do it. It's just a question of, you know, of having a little bit
able to help with that. And perhaps Representative Rafe will make himself available sometime between now and our meeting in October to go around about this as well. I will say that when we think about the possibility of, and I think he took this off the table for the moment, but possibility of people having to report their contributions as well as people having to report the receipt of contributions, we're talking about something in the millions of transactions that that go through OreStar, and to double them up, if you will, or have the potential for them doubling up, we're talking about a major expansion. So sorry for the.
But if we set a threshold high enough.
Yeah, if you set a threshold, or yeah, kept it, but it would be a significant change. I think as well as time and resources to do, or staffing and resources to do things. Elections Division and next Secretary of State will probably be interested in a timeline that allowed them to do a good job of it. Let's not pass, recommend something passed in January that has to be ready, in October, because that's when I think we do a poor job of implementing that kind of thing. So that's my two bits on my way out the door. So if people would get back to me, and I will maybe send out something that we'll ask and say, are there particular issues that we know that we're working on, some of the smaller ones you may not feel like it's worth time to meet about, and that's fine. I'll put together a few little things about them, but some of the bigger categories, if you want to help me think about how to bring some alternatives back to the group.
We don't have a date for an October meeting.
We do have?
Yes. October 20th.
So
an official meeting?
Yes. Oh. 9 to 1.
9 to 1.
Yeah.
One.
Oh, big one.
Oh, no.
So if you want to get some of that work done out of the way before then, offer yourselves up.
And then a reminder after that, December 15th, 9 to noon. So we.
I want to consider scheduling a November meeting.
There was some general consensus about kind of with Thanksgiving, the election, the lead up to the election, that it might be a good time to not have an official meeting. That being said, if there was a work group going on at that time, that might be a good chunk of time to take any concrete ideas we come back with in October. To put together, but that was why.
It doesn't, well, we could have a secretary-elect who would join us at
that
table.
Said, that was the reasoning for it.
That makes sense.
Why aren't the candidates here? You know.
Well, there's for a discussion after we have. Excuse me.
Yes.
Going to adjourn the meeting. Thank you. Going to adjourn the meeting. Thank you.